first episode of the Bardolatry podcast, an official podcast of Minerva Magazine. We're going to be your hosts today. I'm Gabs.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Olivia.
And for our first episode, we are going to talk about cross-dressing leading ladies in some of Shakespeare's most well-known comedies. Just to kind of give you a quick rundown, today we're going to be talking about As You Like It, Twelfth Night, and The Merchant of Venice. So I guess, do we just want to start with As You Like It?
Sure. One of my faves.
Yep, Rosalind is one of my favorite
female heroines.
One of my favorite heroines in Shakespeare. Just such a witty character.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. She's definitely one of my favorite protagonists too. She's hilarious and she has a lot of fun with the cross dressing, which I think is important to talk about.
Yeah, She really does. She might have more fun with it than the other two characters we're talking about today, actually.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah, there's definitely
Yeah, they all have their different reasons for it, but Rosalind really takes on this, you know, empowering role, first, you know, as a protector to Celia, and then as, so she can advance her relationship with, Orlando.
Yeah.
So you really feel like, unlike, you know, Viola's, melancholy state or Portia's clever scheming, you really feel like this is, you know, Rosalind really taking control here.
Mm-hmm. Especially since she doesn't have as much control in her life in the court anyway, because, you know, her father got kicked out, her cousin's taken her in, her uncle, the new duke, clearly doesn't like her. So I think this is a way for her to kind of reclaim her life, at least in this guise.
Yeah,
it's nice that, like, Shakespeare with his heroines, like, often, like, he gives them a chance to take power and do something interesting, even if they're in, like, a crappy situation. So, like, in Rosalind's case, you could just write a play about her being, like, sad and alone in the forest.
Yeah.
And instead, he's like, no, let's let her do stuff.
Yeah.
Take charge. which I have appreciated about a lot of his plays.
Yeah.
Even if she was originally played by a boy, we know, you don't have to email us.
Yeah, but that brings us to the really interesting, because we want to talk about the epilogue, because usually in Shakespeare's plays, we don't really have an epilogue like this at the end, but we do have, you know, the actor at the time playing Rosalind coming out and saying, you know, I'm a boy playing a girl, playing a boy playing a girl, like, am I a woman? Like, just kind of playing with that idea.
Yeah, one of the things I think is interesting about the epilogue, like Katie was saying, like, it's an actor playing a woman, playing a man, and then Rosalind actually does get to change back into her, like, women's garb at the end, and so when Rosalind comes out in this epilogue, she's gonna be wearing a dress, but then nodding to the fact that she's both a boy and a girl, so, like, the play is like, still cross-dressing at this point, and I think it's kind of interesting where, like, comedies are all supposed to end by, like, tying things up and going back to the status quo, that Shakespeare kind of introduces this 14 lines to, like, actually still make the audience a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that goes with, at the time, like, especially when drama was first getting popular, a lot of people were offended by it because they thought that people shouldn't be able to imitate someone like a king on stage because that was lying. So a lot of people saw theater as offensive because they saw it as lying. So that makes this epilogue all the more interesting. You know, she says, I am not furnished like a beggar, therefore to beg will not become me. My way is to conjure you, and I'll begin with the woman. So, you know, kind of going against that, like, you know, everyone's in on the joke, and here, let me tell the woman, here's what you can learn from me pretending to be a woman, and then telling the men, here's what you can learn from me pretending to be a woman, pretending to be a man. Like, this is how you should treat women.
Right.
So it kind of goes along with the whole Rosalind teaching Orlando during the play to actually kind of get a message out to the audience, and it kind of while being on that in-joke that some people are still kind of offended by this in theater. So I think that's Shakespeare's clever way of saying, hey, there is something that you can get from this, and...
Yeah, my favorite line of the epilogue is when she says, if I were a woman, I would kiss as many of you
as had,
as had beards that pleased me, complexions that liked me and breasts that I defied not, which is hilarious. But I love that because a female character, like, in a dress, comes out on stage and then says, if I were a woman.
Exactly, yeah.
And that, yeah, it's, like, taking the audience out of, like, theater land. And
yeah. Well, it's also, it ties back into the way she talks to Orlando throughout the whole Ganymede scenes with him, especially the first line, it is not the fashion to see the lady, the epilogue. Well, she doesn't, she acts like the lady, but the whole language that she uses with Orlando is, like, teaching him that ladies do not have to act the way that men perceive that they act, and women can be so much more than what men think they are. Mm-hmm. So she's purposefully stepping out of that fashion, both with her interactions with Orlando and in the epilogue.
Yeah, yeah. And Shakespeare had to do that in a very clever way, because at the time, he had to stick to the status quo. So at the end of every comedy, even if a woman is defiant, you know, there will be a big happy marriage at the end. Exactly. With and this, there are like four marriages at the end of this play. Oh, yeah. So everyone's tied up quite nicely. You know, Rosalind and Orlando, obviously. And then Celia just randomly marries Oliver. And then all the country bumpkins get married. And then, but with Rosalind with Rosalind kind of subverting traditional gender roles throughout the play, you know, Shakespeare does have that message. So even at the end, when everything does go back to status quo, I think the epilogue is also a nice way of saying that, you know, women can be like this, even though, you know, the ending has to have a fairy tale happily ever after ending.
Yeah, because I could have given the epilogue to Orlando or the Duke, because her father comes back at the end. So by all purposes, she should have been, like, the submissive wife again, but then she comes back out.
Yeah, because, like, yeah, they're going back to the court, they're leaving this fantasy land, but Shakespeare's not willing to, like, hand all that over.
Yeah, no, I don't think Rosalind is either.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I would also actually like to talk about the fact the male disguise that Rosalind puts on, because she doesn't choose, like, a super, like, manly man. She chooses the name Ganymede, which is going to have a lot of implications.
Yes.
Yeah, the young lover of Zeus.
Yeah.
So she, like, she chooses a name of this character who, I mean, like, you know, they wouldn't think gay at the time, that wasn't a term, but, you know, a man who loves men, who's now, like, pretending to be a woman and being in love with a man. So you kind of have this, like, weird mix of, like, homoerotic undertones.
Yeah, especially because Orlando does seem so comfortable at, like, immediately takes off Rosalind as Ganymede's offer to, you know, have this fake wooing every day, and he just takes that up so easily. So it's like, well, does he know that's actually Rosalind disguised and he's just playing along, or does he, like, is he really getting into this thing with Ganymede? Like, there's a lot of homoeroticism there.
And the way that they play it on stage can also highlight that more so. A production I saw a few years ago, it did have Rosalind as Ganymede and Orlando, and Orlando really got into the fake marriage. Like, they came so close to kissing, and then the spell is broken, as it usually is in scenes like that.
Yeah, but that fake marriage, he's like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, he's so,
I know you're a guy, I'll marry you, pretend you're, and there's a line at the beginning of that scene where, like, Rosalind walks in and says something, like, what do you think? And he said, I would kiss before I spoke. And, exactly, like, tries to put a move on this person he thinks he's, like, a dude.
Yeah.
Like, it really makes me go, man, maybe Orlando's, like, more up for fun than, than we originally thought. Which I think is, like, actually great and makes me like Orlando better.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of, and then one thing, that we also should mention is Phoebe, because then we have Phoebe falling in love with this man who is actually a woman. So not only do you have a man flirting with a woman pretending to be a man, but now we have a woman flirting with this very feminine man. So we have, you know, Rosalind is just, you know, all over the spectrum here.
We'll definitely have to compare Phoebe to Lady Olivia in Twelfth Night, because the falling in love with the cross-dressed female thing is interesting to talk about.
But in Phoebe's case, she does kind of, like, I think her happy ending is kind of suspect.
It's so a little bit
tricked,
like,
you.
Consolation prize. Sylvia still loves you, even though you can't have the guy you really
marry
like.
Marry this random dude. Have fun.
Yeah.
Who, like, professes his love really creepily all the time.
Yeah, and I've seen it played where at the end, when Phoebe gets handed off to Sylvia, she's, like, not just disappointed because she has to marry Silvius, but she's disappointed because she still wants to be with Rosin. Like, I've seen it played that way in modern productions.
Even with the reveal, she's like, so what?
Yeah.
I still
you
like
hot. Yeah. Well, that's actually maybe a good point to transition into Twelfth Night.
Sure.
Because if we're thinking about, like, Phoebe being into Ganymede slash Rosalind for the way he acts, and Olivia is kind of...
Not me.
Yeah. Olivia in the play is kind of the same way with Cesario, Viola's alter identity, where she's not really into Cesario just because he's, like, a hot fella, but because he treats her differently than the other men in her life. Because
she's gotten a lot of suits, and that's actually why Viola goes to get to see Olivia in the first place, because she works with Orsino in his court, and he's like, go profess my love to Lady Olivia, because Orsino's trying to get her to marry him, and Olivia is not having it at all. But
yeah, because Orsino just is throwing, like, he's essentially doing the version of, like, putting his name in a Hallmark card and mailing it to her.
That's exactly what that is.
And she's like, I don't care. And so then when Viola as Cesario shows up, Olivia's like, I know what you're going to say, because Orsino never says anything different. And then Viola is like, well, this is what I would actually do. And she's so struck by hearing, like, actual, authentic, original professions of love that it totally wins her over. Which is, I think Malvolio and Sir Andrew, the other guys who are trying to marry her, I mean, they're clearly more buffoons than Orsino is.
Yeah.
But they're kind of doing the same thing, where they're trying to win her over by following a formula.
Exactly.
Like, wear this, smile, say this, whereas Viola's, like, a total wild card, and Olivia's super into that.
Especially since Viola, I think, is pulling the love that she feels for Orsino into her words, so she's genuinely in love with a person, not Olivia, but with a person, and she can profess that passion of love that she feels, and she knows what love actually means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the question is Olivia in love with Viola? Because we were also talking earlier about alternate interpretations, where at the end, what does Olivia say?
Oh, she's like happy day or something.
At the very end, when she sees that, you know, both that she swings both ways and she has both the twins, and she seems like, absolutely delighted.
Yeah,
she says most wonderful.
Love it.
Which, you know, can at the time can mean to be shocked, but you know,
wonderful. The original kind of use of it is more like, that's very wondrous and unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, in the modern day, we say wonderful to say something is great. Yeah. So that's why I think it can be read that way, if you want it to, of Olivia being like, oh, I married the guy twin, but there's another one. That's awesome.
She does that in the Mark Rylance version. She jumps up and down and claps her hands. And, like, there's this awkward silence where everyone looks at her like, what? She's like, nothing. I'm not secretly into both of them. What?
No big guys. Yeah, I would totally read a Twelfth Night sequel. Like,
oh,
if someone wanted to write that,
please.
Where there was, like, crazy stuff going on in
Shakespeare
Illyria.
Shakespeare fanfic. Does that exist?
Yes.
Oh,
does it
exist?
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, She's the Man is an AU.
Oh, that's true.
No,
I meant,
there's,
like,
online. There is online written fanfic.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so we have this Viola and Olivia component, and I guess we were kind of hinting at this, where, like, Rosalind has a lot of fun with her cross-dressing, but Viola's more conflicted about hers.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Hers is more of an act of, like, self-preservation.
Yeah.
Because she thinks that she'll be put to death if people find out who she is.
Mm.
So her cross-dressing has a real element of, like, desperation almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's also that sense of loss, because she doesn't have anyone to share it with, unlike Rosalind, who has Celia, and she's constantly in on the joke. She's usually in the scene with Rosalind, like, giggling behind Rosalind's back because it's so amusing, and she's watching Orlando's interactions, but Viola's completely alone.
Yeah.
You know, and she kind of has Cesare... She kind of has Rosina. Thank you. I was like, I said something wrong here.
No, that's okay.
And she kind of tries to confide in him when she goes into the, like, I know what love to women men may owe. And she's saying, like, I have a sister. Mm. So she's kind of unburdening herself in a very little way in that moment. And she tries to kind of unburden herself to Olivia when she's talking about how passionate she would feel if she were in love with someone. But she doesn't have that companion to giggle with her and back her up.
That's true, yeah.
And that's so important. I think female friendship is, an important part of Shakespeare's plays. And you see that when women do have female companions, they definitely feel more empowered in their hijinks. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to, Portia and Nerissa in a little bit. And we were talking about Rosalind and Celia and how Rosalind initially, puts on the whole show with Celia. But Viola's, a one-woman act here. So you can really, or a one-man act or whatever. So you can really sense, that longing. You know, she understands Orsino's longing and she wants to be able to relate, but she's so melancholy because she's holding it all back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point and lends to... I think As You Like It, of the three comedies we're going to talk about, is the most of, what a modern-day person would think of a comedy, because it's mostly just straight-up fun, mm-hmm. whereas Twelfth Night kind of does have this melancholy to it, especially, with Malvolio's plotline, but Viola, she has that one speech when she's on her own, and she calls herself, a monster.
Yes, I love that speech.
She's really torn about, who she is, and... Yes,
and then even the fact that when she's talking to Orsino and she talks about her fake sister when she's talking about herself, I mean, she says, my sister died. She never spoke of her love.
Yes.
And, she concealed it and then she sat in yellow melancholy.
Yeah, she doesn't seem too optimistic about, where her story is going to end up. And it all kind of does turn out to the better, but I think the, wackiest parts of this play are more of these side characters instead of Viola.
I found the monster line. So first she says, disguise, I see thou art a wickedness, wherein the pregnant enemy does much. And then she says later, and I, poor monster, fond as much on him, and she, mistaken, seems to dote on me. What will become of this?
Yeah.
I feel like Viola is... Especially when I was in high school and I was really getting into the Shakespeare thing, I feel like Viola's the more relatable character to, an adolescent girl, mm-hmm. the feelings of unrequited love and just wanting to, express your feelings and not knowing how and afraid of only being seen as, a friend or one of the guys by, you know, someone you like. And I feel like Rosalind really represents, who... women become when they go to college and get an education and become more empowered. In a way, Rosalind feels more older and in control, and Viola feels younger but relatable to I think that's why I found Viola so relatable in high school, and now in college Rosalind's my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's a great point too, whereas you kind of have this, even if not all of us run around pretending to be a guy, we still have this double side where mm-hmm. this is what I show my friends or like my best version of myself.
Yeah.
And then you might go home and be no one really knows what a neurotic mess of crazy I am.
Especially in front of the person you like. If there's a person you like in high school, you're like, I'm the coolest, you should be best friends with me. Then you go home and you're like, I love you, I love you, I love you, please talk to me.
I did that exact thing for 2 years in high school, and it was terrible.
So. Yep. Oh, who hasn't? Yeah, no, I still do that sometimes.
So we talked about Orlando getting, enthusiastically getting into this, so I just thought we should talk about Orsino.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Because he's not, playing along, Viola's never pretending to be a woman in front of him or anything like that.
Right.
But I still think there is this, erotic undercurrent between Cesario and Orsino.
Definitely.
And just, speaking of productions, Trevor Nunn directed a version of Twelfth Night starring Helena Bonham Carter as Olivia.
One. Yeah.
And Ben Kingsley as Feste, actually.
Yes, yeah, you're right. Wow.
Which is... nuts. So you can actually rent and watch that movie. And there's a scene where Orsino and Cesario ask Feste to sing a song for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, it's staged so that the two of them are in a barn in a rainstorm, mm-hmm. and for some reason, and Feste's there singing to them, and as they're listening to Feste, they just, like, slowly, like, get closer and closer to each other, and their faces kind of turn toward each other, and they are, like, hair's breadth away from kissing when the song ends, and then they're like, oh! And you're like, Manly, okay, we're good now. But I think, like, that's really fun, too, because, again, you can get this, like, undercurrent of, like, you can, you know, you can write it off as, well, Orsino's just doing that because he's attracted to her because she's actually a woman underneath. But then you can say, like, well, if he doesn't actually know that she's really a woman, then
she's a beautiful boy.
I would love to see more Orsino-Sebastian interactions if there were a sequel, because then it's like, if he is attracted to Cesario as a male, how would that translate to his interactions with Sebastian, who is male and never cross-dresses
at all? That's a great point. And I also think, especially with Antonio and Sebastian's interactions, Antonio, you know, who is so devoted to Sebastian, he's actually this really masculine character. You know, he's been in a few fights, he's, you know, he's gotten into some serious trouble. And he, like, takes on, you know, Sebastian, who I have to imagine has to look a bit feminine if Viola can impersonate him, and they look almost exactly alike. So there's that interesting fact, too, that, you know, I think Sebastian and Viola both have kind of this androgynous feel to that, so people are kind of drawn to them.
Yeah,
they just kind of make everyone bisexual.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
If, you know, their bisexuality existed in Shakespeare's time, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's draws everyone more to the center of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's more about falling in love with a person's personality than their appearance, specifically, especially in regard to the women falling in love with women who act as men, but who love them for women.
Yeah,
and, you know, dating back to the Middle Ages, sexual orientation wasn't really a thing. Attraction was more fluid, so even when men were attracted to other men, it was not seen as part of your orientation. Like, you weren't seen as bisexual, it was just more fluid. There really wasn't a word for, you know, that part of your identity, so I think, you know, the fact that Shakespeare does have what we would consider all this, you know, pansexuality in there is, it might have just been saying at the time that, you know, love was a very different concept than what we think of today as being part of one's entire identity, and that love is a lot more fluid. I don't know.
Yeah, it makes you kind of wonder if the Elizabethans were, like, actually somehow less rigid in their, like, gender and sexuality than we are today, even if we're, like...
I feel like they were more involved in marrying in the status, so it was more of a class marriage issue, I think, than like a sexuality, fluidity, or rigidity thing.
And just because we talked about the epilogue and As You Like It, I did want to bring up the end of Twelfth Night.
Sure.
Because we were saying, you know, Rosalind coming out in the epilogue and playing with whether she's a boy or a girl, like, that's kind of a way for Shakespeare to, like, poke fun at the end of a comedy. But... kind of the same thing with Twelfth Night, where Orsino and Viola are going to get married. She is revealed as a girl, but she never changes back into her women's clothes.
True. She walks off stage as a boy, or dressed as a male.
Yeah, so, like, just, like, for a visual cue, you actually do have two men agreeing to marry each other. On stage, and then they walk off stage, and that's it. Like, you never see Viola put on a dress again. And I think that's kind of, like...
Which reminds me of the Mark Rylance production that I mentioned earlier, which you can also buy on DVD from, I believe, the Globe's website, because it's from an original Globe production. There's a moment where Orsino's going to hug Viola, and he almost hugs Sebastian by mistake, because they're so alike that he confuses them, and he, like, walks towards Sebastian and stops, and they kind of look at each other, and then he goes towards Viola, like, oh, sorry. But that's an interesting thing, that you're right, they don't change, and it's almost as if they're still interchangeable up until the last moment.
Yeah, and that, like, Shakespeare's still kind of doing a little bit of subversion there, because if he, like, really, really wanted to go, like, traditional comedy, you might have Viola, like, disappear for a little bit and, like, show up again in a dress and be like, by the way, I'm a girl.
That's what even that this is kind of getting off topic, but there's a medieval there's a medieval story called Silence about a woman who is She's supposed to be a knight her whole life, and she's a man the whole story. And then at the very end, Merlin comes and makes her, literally, like, uses his magic to reveal her as a woman. So you kind of have this precedent where, in these plays, you know, the magic happens, and then everyone's back to a woman, kind of like how the magical ending of As You Like It we were talking about. But it's interesting, because in Twelfth Night, as you were mentioning, she does stay. There's, like, no magical ending where we're left with, you know, Viola just being who we are comfortable seeing Viola as throughout the whole play. We really haven't seen Viola as a woman. That's who we're comfortable with. And I may be wrong on this one, but in Cymbeline, I don't think Imogen?
It's been too long since I read that.
I've actually never read Cymbeline.
Yeah, I don't think Imogen changes back into female dress, but I could be wrong with that, so don't quote me on that.
I feel like that's right, just because I feel like I've read things about it, but I've never read the play, so I'm not positive.
Yeah.
I honestly do not remember.
Okay, well, do we want to go ahead and move on to Merchant of Venice?
Sure.
Yes. Talk about our last lady, Portia.
We have to talk about Jessica a little bit, too, because I just remembered that she also cross-dresses, which is interesting. I forgot about her.
Yeah, is there a female character that doesn't cross-dress in this play?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think all three of them cross-dress.
But something that I want to note, because there's a lot, like, we could talk about so many things in The Merchant of Venice, because there's a lot going on there, but out of all the different personalities we have in this play, Portia is actually the largest speaking role. You know, this is a play that takes place in a man's world, yet she has about 22% of all the play's lines, so she has, she's in more, I think she even has more speeches than Shylock does. So, she is really what is driving this play.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of give a quick, Merchant of Venice is like a very, I think, a very touchy subject for modern people, just because of, like, the Shylock thing, and, like, the Jewish-Christian things, and, like, what was Shakespeare actually doing here? And I think you can get distracted a lot of the time by that.
Yeah.
And it is a very, like, interesting subject, and you shouldn't just dismiss it entirely. But I think it's important to remember that The Merchant of Venice is a comedy, and that people in Elizabethan times would have, like, been delighting in Portia as a cross-dresser, and, like, all of this hilarious, like, nonsense going on. So that's, like, really interesting to me that one of the ways you can kind of see that is that Portia has the most speaking lines in the play. It's not Shylock's play.
Right.
Yeah.
Even if it seems like it to a modern audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is an interesting way for Shakespeare to sneak that issue in under the guise of an otherwise funny, you know, in a funny context. Because, I mean,
yeah, but that's the thing. Shylock is, he's intended to be a villain. Like, we can, in modern times, people will play him differently, but the intent was to make him a villain, but he's a human villain, and that's the sign of a really good villain, is that it will, you know, he will be a fully, you know, feeling, developed character. Like, even Richard III has his moments, so that's the thing. Shakespeare is subversive with Shylock while also kind of sticking to the status quo. But
and we can say the same thing about Portia.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, so true. I was just going to segue into that. Because I think Portia is one of, if not the most intelligent character that Shakespeare, you know, male or female, that Shakespeare has created. I mean, that it's evident from everything she does. But I think Portia is so clever because she doesn't just accept, you know, Bassanio passed her test, but that's a test that her father created for her. And I think Portia, by, you know, the whole ring exchange and going in, is really testing to see if Bassanio is not just another gold digger. Because even though he passes the test, you know, he is in debt to Antonio, and he kind of lies about how much money he has to her. So she is really driving this, and when he kind of fails the test at the end, they all go back, and she doesn't say, this is our house, she says, this is my house, the light's burning in my hall, you know, she's still, you know, the ruler of Belmont at the end of the play, and she's kind of established herself as the dominant partner, because she made a fool out of Bassanio.
Let's go ahead and actually talk about what that test is a little bit, just so someone, like, is a little unfamiliar.
Yeah.
Just because I was thinking, like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, we all know what's up. So basically, just to like, give you a quick reminder, refresher, Portia lives on the island of Belmont, where she like is super rich, and Antonio has to go to trial because all his ships sank and he failed to repay Shylock. So Bassanio goes rushing to support him, and then Portia dresses up as a male lawyer and goes and like manipulates the whole trial and ends up getting Antonio off. And then after the trial, she's talking to Bassanio, who doesn't know that like this is his wife. Asks him if he will give her his wedding ring as payment for what she has done.
And it's not, at first he does say, you know, this is really important, I can't just give it away. And she actually leaves. But then Antonio says, oh, you know, you really owe it to this doctor. You know, you should really give. So after Antonio persuades him to do it, then
he's like, okay.
Then the ring is delivered to Portia, and she's like, oh, this isn't good.
Yeah, so he might have passed her father's test by picking the right chest, but he definitely did not pass her test of keeping the ring.
Yeah. And that's something that's kind of cool about Portia is I've seen writing about her before where people are like, well, you know, yeah, she seems powerful, but she is kind of hemmed in by these rules her father left behind for her. but you have to ask yourself, is she actually doing this because, like, a man dictated it, or is it, like, a really easy way for her to get rid of suitors that she doesn't want?
I like that motivation a lot. I would definitely take advantage of that. Yeah. Be like, I can't marry you. My father said you need to pass this test, and
And I've heard of, like, performances before where Bassanio's trying to decide on the right casket. Portia will actually be like, like pointing at him.
We knew she already did favor him from, you know, she mentions that of all her suitors, he's probably the most worthy, so.
Yeah, so that's like another way for Portia to be subversive, where she's on the surface following what these like men dictate she should do, but then she's actually playing it to her favor, which is basically what she just does the whole play.
That's true.
One of the things I really like about Portia is that in the trial scene, like whatever you think of her logic and if law should actually work that way, we'll just kind of ignore all of this.
She's just really big on semantics.
But, I think it's just important to note that, like, even if she is dressed as a man when she, like, makes this triumph, you know, she does kind of have to do that to be taken seriously by this world of men in Venice.
So probably just to get into the court.
But it still is a woman outsmarting every single man in the play.
And they're all super like, wow, that's such a brilliant move. Why did we not think of that? They're in awe of how smart she is.
And even when they do find out at the end of the play that she's the doctor, like I said earlier, it's not, oh, let's have this happy celebration of Bassanio and Portia. It's like, Portia's like, I'm returning to my house. Like, this is my house and you're going to make amends for, you know, the trouble that you put me and Nerissa through because you were bad husbands. So she's still in control at the end of the play. And that's, I think that's why Portia is one of Shakespeare's most subversive characters in all of his canon.
She's
super interesting.
Do we want to talk about Jessica too?
Really fast, because she likewise cross dresses in order to sneak out of her house to marry, I forget, who does she marry?
Lorenzo.
Lorenzo. Yeah. Like, I know there's like three sidekicks, and two of them there's names so start with many S, sidekicks. And then there's like one other sidekick.
Graciano is the one who's like completely worthless.
So she sneaks out to marry Lorenzo, and I can't find the line, but she's embarrassed to be dressed like a guy. When Lorenzo's looking for her, she's like, oh, I don't want to see you. I'm really glad it's night so that you can't see me in this awful man clothes thing that I'm wearing. So it's very interesting that she's ashamed of her, of what she has to do to get out of her house, and Portia's like, I will dress like a guy, and this is gonna be great.
I think it's, she might be carrying over the shame she feels, you know, from Shylock, and she just doesn't have that empowerment, because her whole life she's just been ashamed of who she is. Maybe I'm being too deep here, but
I think it's also another class thing, because I mean, Portia, you know, she's queen or herself on Belmont, and she can do whatever she wants.
And she's dressing up as a doctor, not like a peasant.
So I wonder if it's also more of a class thing.
Jessica's, more just like, random boy in disguise.
Yeah.
I guess maybe it would be the equivalent of, like, walking out, you know, a really girly girl walking out in, like big baggy shirt and, like, pants, like, down around her ankles and, like, a backwards, like, you know, cap and, like, oh, I look gross. I look, like, sketchy.
As opposed to, like, a nice business suit. Yeah, like, the tie.
Yeah, the tailored suit.
Like,
the fedora.
Like,
the...
like, yeah. It's like, I'm the polished version of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that Portia's cross-dressing is just, like, more fancy, so she's having a better time doing it.
Yeah.
But also, you can also think about the different reasons they're cross-dressing.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of the combo here where, like, you know, As You Like It, it's kind of fun with cross-dressing. Twelfth Night is kind of, like, out of necessity.
Yeah.
And then Merchant of Venice, you have Jessica who cross-dresses, like, to escape her home, mm-hmm. which to her is basically a matter of life or death. Because, she really wants to marry this guy.
And her father would probably, maybe not kill her, but definitely take drastic actions to punish her for leaving.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So,
especially
because
she took all his money.
Yeah. Yeah. And Portia, I mean, she is dressing as a man for a very, very serious reason as well. But I think hers is a little more current of humor because, you know, if she wanted to, she could have just chilled out at Belmont and let Antonio die.
I think she needs to teach Bassanio a lesson. Like, you think you can put your friend, potential boyfriend, before me, but I'm gonna be your wife, and also I'm, like, sponsoring and supporting our marriage.
Absolutely.
So you gotta respect me, because the first sign of Antonio being in trouble, you, like, ran away.
Yeah, absolutely. And so at the very end, when Portia gives Bassanio the letter revealing that she was the doctor, Antonio says, "I am dumb," and I think what he's really thinking is, shit, she saw our bromance.
Exactly.
Shit, that courtroom scene, they're so intense, and Bassanio says he's ready to die for him above his own wife, and Portia, and what is
Portia's like, don't tell your wife that.
And Portia, Portia says, your wife would give you a little thanks for that if she were by to hear make you the author. So Bassanio at the end is like, oh, sweet Portia, if you didn't know to whom I gave the ring, if you didn't know for whom I gave the ring, and we could see for what I gave the ring, and how unwillingly I left the wing, when not would be accepted, but the ring, you should abate the strength of your displease. And Portia says, if you had known the virtue of the ring, or half her worthiness that gave the ring, or your own honor to contain the ring, you should not have parted with the ring. Like, she's so sassy, she lays it down on him, and, you know, embarrasses him, and sets herself up as the dominant person in that relationship, and she's just so much fun, so clever, so witty.
I think Bassanio, like, honestly, is just kind of the, like, submissive party in all of his relationships.
Yeah.
Because, like, Antonio is totally funding him, too, and, like, the reason he can get this. And then he, like, marries a woman who's like, yeah, I'm in charge of you.
Yeah.
I think Bassanio just, like, must not be able to get the upper hand.
Yeah, and I think her primary motivation for going to the trial scene was to test Bassanio.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, because Bassanio, you know, when he's talking to Antonio about wounding Portia, he compares himself to Jason. And if you know Greek mythology, when he's in pursuit of the Golden Fleece, he uses Ariadne and then, you know, gets rid of her. So you have this character who, you know, uses a woman's support and then gets rid of her. So I really think that Portia is trying to make sure that, you know, he was more clever than the other suitors. He chose the right box. But then again, he probably was expecting that there was more to what it seems. So I'm going to test him and make sure he's really not a gold digger. And I don't know if he really passed the test.
Well, she's like the Medea to his Jason, because she just saves the day all the time.
Yeah.
I think she could also, you know, it's kind of a way for her to lord it over. Like, now Antonio doesn't have power over her anymore, because she's like, I saved your life. She's like, so, you know, I saved your little boyfriend's life, and I have all the money and all the power, and so, like, now you have to, like, there's kind of, like, a double thing there, where she's, like, not only testing him and teaching him a lesson, like, about how he has to accept this marriage as important, but also being like, I'm in charge of everyone, so.
She just likes being the ruler.
Yeah. I do love that Antonio just says, I am dumb.
That's definitely the OC.
She saw everything.
I should just,
What a great line for modern. Yes. I'm dumb.
Don't you love Shakespearean endings where everything just reveals itself so nicely.
Yeah. Since we're talking epilogues, who says the last line? Is it Portia?
It's actually Gratiano, which is odd.
Yeah. She has the second.
She's the second to last.
Oh, yeah, it's Nerissa's husband. I was like, who is he again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's like Bassanio's little lackey, basically.
Yeah, he's basically Bassanio Jr.
Lesser Bassanio.
Lesser Bassanio, which doesn't say much because they're both kind of little skeezes.
It's kind of one of those things where, like, again, Nerissa, who's, like, a pretty good companion to Portia, like, her great friend, also smart, like Celia, both of them just kind of end up with, like...
Yeah. The sidekick of the guy that main female protagonist marries.
Although with Gratiano, I find it more offensive just because he's the one in the trial who's, like, just repeating what everyone else says.
Yeah, he's a parrot.
Yeah, I think he even says something worse than Bassanio, like, oh, I would have my wife, like, dead in heaven rather than rather than have this happen to Antonio or something. He's like that. And Nerissa is there to hear that she's, you know, cross-dressing too, and she hears that too, and it's like, oh.
Yeah.
So, actually, Merchant of Venice is, like, even taking this cross-dressing further because in As You Like It, you have the female companions, but Celia's disguise is just, like, a peasant girl. Yeah. But here we have Portia and Nerissa are both cross-dressing as men.
Yeah.
Instead of doing, like, a guy and a girl.
Yeah. Yeah, because she's, like, the doctor's apprentice when they come out.
I don't know. I think that's... I don't know what that says, but it's actually...
Well, it's interesting that Gratiano's also stupid enough to give his. Like, I'll give my ring away, too! It's like, you didn't really need to do that, but okay.
Maybe there's, like, a whole, like, chain of unrequited love. Like, Antonio loves Bassanio, and then Gratiano loves
Bassanio.
I mean, or something.
Everyone loves Bassanio. Why? He's not that great.
I know, exactly. Well, some jerks just get all the dudes.
All the girls. Especially since Gratiano's like, and the dudes. Is Gratiano's like the first. He's like, Bassanio gave his ring away. I even wrote Tattletale on the margin here because I'm like, why? What? Yeah.
Yeah. Gratiano. Gratiano. You get an F minus.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because the Nerissa character really didn't have to be there. I mean, Portia's a very strong presence. Yeah. She doesn't need, especially because, you know, there are only like usually two or three female characters in these plays, so Nerissa really didn't have to be there, so I just find it really refreshing whenever Shakespeare has this, you know, this, like, female duo, like, partner in crime throughout his plays, and...
She's especially important at the beginning when she's talking to Portia about all of her potential suitors, and Portia's going through the list like, well, he's bad, and he's awful, and we don't want to marry him either, and I think that part of their relationship's super interesting, and then I feel kind of bad for Nerissa, because it kind of seems like she just becomes a shadow toward the end.
Yeah.
But she's definitely very present in at least the first act.
And maybe it's just a way to keep Portia from being, like, Viola.
True.
He's like, you know, Portia does have a confidant. So, like, even if she is, like, a powerful person, like, she still does, like, have concerns about marrying the right guy. And, like, she's lonely, too. And so giving her Nerissa is a way of making sure that she's not... like, doesn't have that tragic element.
So Portia could become an Olivia, did she not have Nerissa. Because Olivia's like that, too. She's powerful, she's alone, and she's like, I don't want to marry anybody.
Yeah.
Just close my doors.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, is that Portia and Olivia are in very similar situations, yet they handle it so differently.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why we need a Twelfth Night sequel, because we just need, like, Olivia and Viola to be, like, bro-ing out the whole play so that they can, like, female companionship, yes!
Oh my goodness, yeah, like, Orsino and Sebastian go fishing. And they're just, like, in the court.
Like, the real love story here is that we finally have a female friendship with these two women who were, like, starved for companionship. Mm. Maybe that's the real point.
Exactly. Yeah, because she's even like, a sister, you are a she. She doesn't care about, like, marrying Sebastian or whatever. She's just like, Viola's in my life again. This is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So then my question, with all these talk of female companions, is if all of these plays pass the Bechdel test.
Okay. So we definitely think that As You Like It does, in fact, pass the Bechdel test.
Rosalind and Celia actually have conversations, like, about their relationship and how they feel and things. Because I think one of the things, like, the Bechdel test is pointing out is that while people do talk about their love interests, women, like, talk about a lot of other things besides just, like, that cute dude over there.
No.
Yeah. Which, I mean, is definitely in there. So it's part of what makes a female complex, talking about love interests and things. But they also talk about personal feelings.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. It's a very realistic female friendship, and I just think that's so important to show in Shakespeare's plays. So they do talk about Orlando, but they also talk about supporting each other, and they have witty banter with Touchstone at the beginning. And Celia, you know, stands up for Rosalind, and they even leave together. So it's just nice to see, like, a real female relationship in a test that, you know, even though Shakespeare's plays were written 400 years ago, it's a very low bar to set. And many movies these days still don't pass the Bechdel test. So it's really nice to see that in something where people think, you know, back, oh, women didn't really have that much freedom back then. It's like, well, they do now, supposedly, but the Bechdel test is, it still has to be a thing.
Yeah, so Shakespeare, for whatever reason, was at least writing, like, women having a relationship with each other.
They were definitely complex, well-thought-out female characters.
Yeah.
That had feelings. Shocking. expressed their opinions. Wow. Surprise!
Then in Twelfth Night, we have... we talked about how, like, neither Olivia or Viola has a female companion.
Right.
But they do talk to each other.
Yes.
And the fact that Viola is dressed as a man at the time... I mean, there's still two women talking to each other.
And I think the way they interact and the way they relate, I think Gabs, you brought up this point, when they're talking about Olivia's face as a picture. It's like Viola can be that intimate in her language with Olivia because she understands what Olivia's going through. And they're on the same level.
Yeah, like, I think Viola knows Olivia's craving, like, authentic feeling.
Right.
Because she's also hoping that, you know, Orsino... or whoever is going to, or anyone for that matter, is going to like understand her, because she can't reveal herself to anyone. And so in that way, they're able to emotionally connect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why all the other men in the play fail to impress Olivia, because they never bother to think about what she feels like.
Yeah.
What she's going through.
Absolutely.
So Twelfth Night does pass as well.
Yeah, we're going to go ahead and give that a pass, even though there's the cross-dressing element, because...
Yeah.
Okay, so then Merchant of Venice...
I don't think so for the Merchant of Venice, because even though Portia and Nerissa do have a strong companionship, I can't really think of any times where they're not talking about either their suitors' husbands or Portia's father. So, you know, it, like, that relationship is a good one and a strong one, but unfortunately...
It's just too focused. Yeah. That play is too focused around, like, the marriage stuff going on for
Portia's,
them to...
Yeah, Portia's suit is what... I think there's the line, you know, when she's initially sad and Nerissa asks, oh, why are you sad of the world? What's wrong? And it's, of course, about the task that her father has left to any of her suitors. So that's all kind of tied up in Portia's feelings. So it's kind of hard to extract the two.
Yeah, so maybe if we had, like, a Merchant of Venice, like, Portia and Nerissa... before her father dies, or, like, Portia and Nerissa, like, after the act, or, like, after the actions of a Merchant of Venice, like, maybe in that case, they would be talking about other things, because they wouldn't necessarily be concerned with, like, suitors and getting married, and, like, since that's kind of what's consuming them.
Then they'd probably be like, look at how stupid our husbands are.
Yeah. That's just, like,
they're already talking about that. That's true.
They're going to totally do the thing where, like, why don't you guys go run off and do something so we can, like, have adult conversation.
Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Oh, and then actually one other thing I just wanted to bring up. I was thinking about the fact that originally all of Shakespeare's plays would have been a boy dressed up as a woman, and then the cross-dressing, like, adds the new thing. And Scott and I were discussing, what that means about female characters and et cetera, et cetera. And, like, is the good traditional way to perform the plays is, like, by doing an all-male cast. And then I was thinking, well, the plays were written, you know, like, 1600-ish. And then the Glorious Revolution and Charles II happened in, like, the 1660s, and then women were allowed on stage. So if you look at the whole trajectory of history, women have been performing in Shakespeare plays for far longer than men were playing women's roles.
It's true.
And one of the reasons I think it works so well is because even if he knew a boy was going to be a woman on stage, he actually wrote, like, psychologically real
characters. Yeah. it's not just a guy wearing a dress. It's
a
complex female character that just happens to be performed by a male actor.
Yeah. And it's just a shame. I wish we had more accounts from, you know, the actors back. Like, I really would have liked to have known, you know, the actor that played Rosalind or Viola or Portia, like, what it was like for them to get into that female character, because these days it's quite the opposite. When I was in high school and we did Shakespeare plays, the cast would mostly be women playing men, so just like an abundance of women, you know, putting on these, you know, male personas. But I really would have liked to have seen when it was like, I really would love to see first-hand accounts from that time.
That would be so interesting.
And just how you approached acting back then, like, if they...
Because didn't, I don't know if I'm misremembering this, but didn't most of the changing for scenes happen, like, in full view of the audience, or
I'm not exactly sure, but they had to do very quick costume changes, so.
Because I know there was a play, I feel like it might have been a production of As You Like It, I didn't see it, but I think I read about it, where there was... Or maybe it was Two Gentlemen of Verona. It was a play that involved cross-dressing, of course. Yeah. There was, like, just a curtain on the side, but the audience could fully see characters changing in and out of costumes, so you knew who was doubling as who.
That makes it even more real. Yeah, because these days, I once saw a production of Measure for Measure, where there were a lot of people were double cast, but because there's so much disguise going on, it's like, wait, is he a duke and, like, a friar, or is he the same person? So
yeah,
that can get
like an
confused.
Actor playing two different characters, or is this the one character dressing up as another character?
Yeah, so that's actually a really clever way of having the audience know whether someone is double cast or whether they're in disguise, because that can get very confusing, because disguise is everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then it's another element of the audience being in on the jokes, or in on the scheme as well.
I feel like the audience, Shakespeare does write that... For the audience, for us, like, laughing at these, like, stupid, like, oh, these stupid people, can't you see that's your wife?
Yeah.
Can't you see that's your wife's ring? And she knows, like, you're so stupid.
I am dumb.
Yeah. I am dumb.
I am dumb.
It's just the overall conclusion of these people. I am dumb. All right, so, we mentioned this at the beginning, but our podcast is part of Minerva Magazine, which is a geek-centered publication. Clearly, we're interested in telling women's stories. That's what this podcast was focused on. So if you happen to find us through a different avenue and you're interested in checking out more of what we have to say and other things besides Shakespeare, we do have a website. You can find us at www.minervamag.com. You can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @MagMinerva. And we also have a Facebook page, and we cover the whole gamut. So if you are into Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, basically anything and everything under the sun, books, movies,
video games,
then you can go check that out.
Yep. Well, thanks for listening. It's been fun.
Yeah, and I guess we will see y'all next time.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.